Accession number 24193, Reel 1.
Tony Towle, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Towle?
I was born on the 16th of April 1931 in Stony Stratford, which is somewhere in the Midlands.
And could you tell us a little about your childhood and your family background? Did you stay in Stony Stratford?
No, we didn't stay in Stony Stratford. We came to Canterbury in Kent, where my father had a hairdressing business, largely doing the haircutting of soldiers at the beginning of the war.
The Second World War?
The Second World War, in the 1939-1940 build-up. We lived typically in Military Road in Canterbury, which subsequently became the area of rather heavy bombing. But I went to Canterbury. I remember going to Broad Street School, being asked to make a little speech at the coronation to parents about the empire, and using a daisy to symbolize the colonies, as we used to call them, with the yellow part being the crown and the center, and the petals being the countries of what we now call the Commonwealth. I remember doing that and being absolutely terrified.
So this was six or seven.
And then we started the build-up. I remember hearing my father saying, well, the Nazis have climbed down. I remember that very clearly. And I imagine they were all in their aeroplanes coming to get us. And they climbed down and landed. But, of course, he was talking about, I think, the Chamberlain appeasement type of issue. And about that time, my education came around, and I became a member of the Canterbury Cathedral Choir School. And
tell us a bit about that school. Were you a day boy there?
I was a day boy, living literally half a mile from the cathedral. And my parents were still there, so I would walk to work. I had to go and sing and have a test. And I wasn't really very musical, and I sang once in Royal David City to the precentor, Joseph Weston Poole of Canterbury Cathedral, a distinguished musician, and Alfred Deller, who was a very well-known, very famous contralto. And they heard me sing once in Royal David City, desperately off-key, and they said, well, we have a lot of work to do here, but we think we can work on you. You can come and report on Monday, the next day. So I became a day boy, and then the war started in seriousness, and we started singing in the crypt of Canterbury Cathedral.
Can you tell us a bit about the operation of the school before we go on to the war? I mean, I'm not very familiar with the school. Was it set up just for choir boys?
It was set up basically to sing in Canterbury Cathedral at the choral services, and your pay, my parents were not wealthy, your pay was virtually a free education. I think you got sixpence of service, and that was credited towards your education cost. And if there was a debit at the end of a term, then your parents made up that issue. But it's part of the dean and chapter of Canterbury Cathedral, of that establishment. And once you're promoted from a probationer to a chorister, you have the right to be married, buried, and have your children christened in Canterbury Cathedral for ever.
What about the actual education you got there? I mean, was it a full education?
Or it was pre-prep school. I think they did their best. We sang a lot. We had to read music. I would think out of a full day, at least half was spent on learning to read music, learning to sing, and learning the anthems and the chants and so on that we as choir boys did. We then got herded into a tower in Canterbury Cathedral for our education, and that was basically the day. But we sang every day.
There mustn't have been, it didn't sound like there was that much time left for education. Reading, writing, was much else?
Not much else. There was a bit of French, which I did terribly badly. A little bit of arithmetic, and I think basic English. They were terribly fussy about your pronunciation and your alliteration of words. because it was part of the singing, the complete act. And as a result, I think I still followed that through.
You went there from what year? From how?
That would have been 39, late 39, to about 42, when I then went to the King's School, Canterbury, which was a public school, a private school, is now called a public school. And that was also involved and integrated with Canterbury Cathedral. It a school which had really rough economic times. And they found a superb headmaster called Canon Shirley, Fred Shirley, who was more a businessman, I think, than a headmaster. And he was able to raise money, refound the school, and turn it into a very successful educational system, including a really rather high standard of education.
And again, you were a day boy.
And then, up to that point, I was a day boy. Then I became a boarder because the school insisted.
What year was that?
That would have been 42 or 43.
In your first year at King's School, you had to become a boarder.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about life? What a typical day would be like at King's School, as you remember it?
You got up very early. You went for a cross-country run. You had a cold shower. You then had lessons in the morning and games, mandatory, in the afternoon.
Every afternoon?
Every afternoon, except one day a week, and I think that was Monday. And that was your own leisure time, which I think was organised.
What were the teaching methods like? How academic a school was it? Always games more important? You know, what was the balance in its curriculum?
I think education and achievement was very much more important than games. I think the school quickly divided into the scholars or potential scholars and those that really might be on the edge and the rest. I was clearly in the rest. And at the bottom of the class. And I do remember every day in the chapter house in Canterbury Cathedral, the school had its assembly. And near school certificate time, I think in order to stimulate the students, the headmaster would read out a list of guest achievements at your school certificate. A lot of boys would get a pass or a credit in this language. Some of us got fails in all of them. And one went out, so either embarrassed and ashamed or angry and determined to prove the headmaster wrong. I came in that category because I don't think I was expected to do anything. And I, in fact, ultimately passed all of them. But, of course, all over this period, the war started.
I'll come back to the war. Right. I really will. What sort of discipline was employed there? Was it a harsh discipline?
It was a very harsh discipline. It was the prefect system and fag system at that time. Fag, the younger boys being servants of the senior boys. For example, there would be a call, fag, down the corridor, and the last person to arrive got the job. So you can imagine there was a helter-skelter to get there first, and always the last to arrive was ordered to do the job. And that could be going out into Canterbury to buy things, to clean shoes, to carry coal up to the senior's study, to press clothes, to do the laundry. So it was a very strict, almost a bullying system, but not aggressively and not physically, except that when you were punished, you would go to the chapter house, this beautiful, beautiful building, and there the main punishment was to run in circles with your hands held above you, with a senior monitor, prefect, with a long, twitchy cane who would just touch your bottom with a sting if you slacked your arms. And you try running around in circles, holding your arms above your head for 15 minutes. It's quite tough. You used to be sentenced to writing 500 times or 1,000 times, manners maketh man, or things in Latin. But gradually, unfortunately, one grew out of being the youngest on the block to the next term, and the difference between a term was very significant in rank. It's rather like being a private in the army to a lance corporal, to a sergeant, and so on. But that was the masters seldom, and the housemasters seldom disciplined. They ensured that you were assembly was there, the food was there, the grace was said, but the discipline was basically left to the senior boys, the prefects.
Did you have any favourite subjects, you know, or?
Yes, I liked geography. I was fascinated with the world because I was determined at that time to go out and see the world. I loved geography. I did very well in it. I loved history because living in Canterbury Cathedral, you could not avoid history. It was all about you. And I was not an arts person. I liked chemistry, and I was good at chemistry. I liked making things that would go bang or smoke, and ultimately that became a little more sophisticated. But thereafter, there were no other achievements in that.
No games.
No, I was never a great athlete. I got to the second 15 for rugby. I would throw weights, that's right, I would throw the javelin and weights and the discus. Not a runner of any form. And hockey, which came on very strongly throughout my career. I learned to play hockey at King's Canterbury, and they had a very good team. And hockey was a lot of fun, a lot of gamesmanship to it, and a lot of learning to be a team. You were passing the ball all the time. You were taught very early on not to be the star. And if you held the ball for more than a few seconds, somebody, probably one of the masters from the touchline, would yell, pass it, and glare at you. So you were taught that way.
Did they have an OTC?
Yes, they did. And I joined that, and I enjoyed it very much. I remember going to my first, after a week or so, they took us to the range and handed us 303 Enfield rifles, which had been rejigged for 22s. And I fired my first rifle, 22, at a target. I had no idea about the foresight. I thought the foresight protectors were the thing you aimed. The net effect, for many times, I got a score of absolutely zero. And so I got sort of relegated and then sent back and back and back. But I enjoyed the OTC very much indeed.
What sort of training did you have? Could you give us an idea of how far they took you along?
Obviously, marching and discipline, because that was very easily done. Arms drill, so drilling, and then field training. I used to love the field days.
What would a typical field day be like?
A field day would be going into the country. The enemy was depicted to be in a wood, and you were either a soldier or a lance corporal or a sergeant for the day, and you were told to get to that wood and defeat the enemy. It really was rather fascinating. Again, teamwork of two of you working together and covering two other people who advance. So you learnt about covering fire. You learnt about craftsmanship in camouflage. You learnt about the lie of the land, taking care of what's now called or dead ground behind hills, moving under cover, not being on the horizon, skyline, which used to come back into career many times when I would shout, get off the skyline! And that would take me straight back to the fields around Canterbury. So that was fun. Other than that, King's Canterbury was really not an ecclesiastical school, but an honours student. Bright scholars were honoured. They wore different clothes. We had weird clothes to wear. We had wing collars, straw hats, black coats, striped trousers, and we wore those three or four times a week. The scholars and the prefects all wore hoods, bright red and green, and looked very dashing, and I longed to be one of them, but mentally I knew I was not going to get there. But it was a great experience, and I liked it. I didn't go home at all during that time. My father was in the army and he'd gone away.
Now, let's go on. Let's switch back to the war then. Do you remember the day war broke out?
Yes, I do. We were herded in Military Road into a school and given a gas mask in a cardboard box, which most of us children flatly refused to put on because we were terrified. We thought we were going to be gassed or it was uncomfortable and couldn't breathe. And we were told to carry it with us always, as we did. And then nothing happened to the war, and we all thought, well, it was a silly sort of war, and no excitement. I can't remember how long that lasted, maybe 6 months. And then suddenly the air raids started, and Canterbury was on the line to London. It was very close to France. There were the Battle of Britain fought overhead. We used to watch these dogfights. When we could escape authority, masters, etc., we would rush to be there at the first crash site of a German aircraft or one of ours, hoping to either capture an enemy or help our own wounded, and often to try and take pieces of the aeroplane. And one of the great things to do was, you know, you trade these pieces, particularly if it had part of the insignia of a swastika, or you'd take part of the windscreen, the perspex. You'd cut a square, maybe an inch square. You'd get a red-hot poker, which was quite hard to achieve as a boy at school, but you would. And then you would burn through that square and make a hole. And then you would file and sandpaper the square edges down and make a ring out of it. Quite useless, but we got an immense amount of thrill. And we would trade that for many more things, like a few bits of shrapnel and so on. But the dogfights...
What could you see of the dog? I mean, could you actually follow what was going on, or too far away?
What we would do, and we didn't know the strategies, or the tactics, rather, obviously, but you would see, you'd lie on the ground in fields and look up, and you would see the aircraft. You could distinguish the enemy often, because these fights seemed to take place quite low, and you would see when one was hit, and a number crashed in this area, and you could see where they went down. We did find a German pilot getting out of his aircraft before anybody else got there. I mean, four or five of us, terribly proud of this. And the German got out in perfectly good English and said, good morning or good afternoon. Can you find some soldiers for me? I want to surrender. In perfect English. And we were all terribly embarrassed, didn't know what to do. We had unpleasant experiences of people who were either killed or badly wounded. Some aircraft burnt. The Home Guard, which was normally... local people, there were many of them, and they were around, and they often got there before we did, and they guarded the crashed aircraft. But we would love to get there and get souvenirs. But in Canterbury, on two occasions, there is a mound, an historic mound called the Dane John, inside the walls of Canterbury Cathedral, and a group of us were... We seemed to have a lot of spare time somehow at that time from school, and we would be... Or it may have been in the holidays when we couldn't go home. We would be on the Dane John, and you'd often get light bombers, German bombers, coming over, and they would dive-bomb Canterbury. It was just within range. And on one occasion, we were on one side of the Dane John, and two aircraft came down and actually machine-gunned us. And we ran around the other side and thought that was very clever and a little bit frightened, but pleased we survived. And then the aircraft turned around and came back and had another go at us, so we had to run around the other side. And they dropped two bombs and then went away. And the other time was in the memorial garden in the precincts of Canterbury Cathedral. I was just going to school, and there was an early morning raid, and the memorial garden is 50 square, 50, 30 yards square, and they dropped a bomb right the opposite side of the square in which we were in, a few of us, and we'd thrown ourselves to the ground, as one spent a lot of time in ditches and so on, and knew that we were under attack. But this bomb landed, you know, 50 yards away from us, blew lots of concrete around and damaged the war memorial, and really rather frightened us. But we found souvenirs, very hot shrapnel, which we increased the price when we traded with other people because it was fresh. And the other memory was the Red Dean of Canterbury, Dr. Hewlett Johnson. The Red, because he was a genuine communist in the sense of the biblical sense. He had a dual cross from Stalin and believed really that one should share everything. And he was not popular in Canterbury, although as a dean you have tenure for life, and it was not possible for him to be removed. But there was a feeling he should have been during the war. But he preached brilliant sermons about, you know, Christianity and sharing. But people would get up and walk out in the middle of his sermons to express their displeasure. But on one bombing raid, when the library of Canterbury Cathedral was hit, and there were documents everywhere fluttering in the breeze, some burnt, and the deanery had been bombed, and there Dr. Hewitt Johnson was sitting with a little primer stove, and he had two strips of bacon and a fried egg that he was sitting on a stone cooking himself. I knew him quite well in a formal sense, so he would say, "Hello, Tony." And I looked at these eggs and bacon, of course, because the rationing was such that you hardly ever saw an egg, and certainly not bacon. And he said, "You remember about Christianity, don't you? You share." And I said, yes, sir. And he said, "Would you like to share my breakfast?" I said, "Oh, sir." He said, "Sit down." And he gave me a strip of bacon and half a piece of egg. I ate it with difficulty. But a wonderful man. And for my birthday, he gave me a book that I couldn't ever read then or now, because it was so complicated, called Socialist Sixth of the World, and he wrote it. But I think that covered the war. One got used to bangs. Oh, then the heavy bombing by night came.
Of London?
No, of London, and the Germans switched their tactics from daylight attacks to night bombing. And I think what often happened is that, they followed the Thames, which was visible most nights because of the moon and so on, and dropped their bombs, and then would accident, or if they were damaged, would unload a lot of bombs in and around this area back to France. But then when we started bombing Cologne and so on, there were tits for tats clearly going on. And Canterbury received its bombing every time Cologne or a cathedral city in Germany was bombed. And we had some very heavy bombing.
What do you remember of them?
Going into shelters, Anderson shelters, dug in the grounds. Anderson shelters were the curved shelters. Morrison shelters were the flat, oblong shelters, which were normally put in cellars of houses. And you'd spend the night there. And the bombs would come nearer and nearer and nearer and be very frightening. And I remember crying. Being rather very frightened. Somehow it doesn't matter in daytime. But at night, and you had nothing to do except sit there, and they would come closer and closer and closer. I was not in a building that was ever directly hit, but all around us, all around the streets of the cathedral, Burgate, all very old historical areas, narrow streets. We would always say, it used to be said, that the Germans were widening the streets for us to improve the traffic flow. And I think that probably came a bit later in interpretation. And it's fun now to see Germans visiting Canterbury Cathedral and appreciating the broad streets around the cathedral, little knowing, of course, that comment and what happened historically. But it was very frightening, the night bombing, and you would spend many nights.
These air raid shelters at the school or at home? Or?
All around the school, and there were public shelters. So if you were caught, and I think there was basically a curfew, you weren't really allowed out at night.
What was it like in the air raid? You said you were nervous, but what was it actually like sitting in them, as the different types?
You couldn't see to read. You in the Morrison shelters, the flat shelters, you couldn't really sit up, so you had to lie down. And you were fed up with lying down, and getting up to spend pennies and so on was very difficult. A lot of us would try and go outside, but that wasn't allowed, but we'd try and creep out anyway. You were very bored, very frightened. There was nothing to do. People would sing, and we'd learn and sing lots of songs, and that would help. But you can't sing all night. And I think it became very frightening. And then, thank heavens, the all clear, rather like a bird singing, would sound, and we'd shoot out and walk around and find buildings in flames and incredibly penetrating dust that was everywhere, making people choke. And it was hard to see, because most of these bombs were very close. And people would come and say, oh, look, there's the cafe, that's gone. Oh, I wonder what happened there. And there weren't sirens anymore. I think, you know, there weren't enough sirens around on firing.
What about the blackout? How good was that, both at the school, at home, and generally?
Oh, very strict indeed. The cathedral particularly, all the lovely stained glass, very old, really very valuable stained glass, have been switched to wooden boardings, and the glass had been sent to coal mines in Wales. And lights were dimmed, if there was electric, mainly candles, and blackout was very, very carefully, and I'd forgotten about that. And there was always somebody to say and yell at you. A lot of firebombs were dropped on Canterbury. We used to do, the more senior boys were allowed to be fire watchers.
What and was that like?
Well, you were sat on a high part of the cathedral, generally with an adult, and there were buckets of sand, buckets of water, and that's all you had, and incendiary bombs, about a foot long, with a fin and solid magnesium, I think it was, that burnt.